latest breaking news stories, visit the ACB Radio newsroom at www.acbradio.org. All the news, all the time. From the world's leading news organisations like CNN, the BBC, the New York Times, the Toronto Star, the Wall Street Journal, and more. That's all the news, all the time, in the ACB Radio newsroom at www.acbradio.org.
Hello, this is Blind Line, the weekly, original, interactive, international talk show for blind and vision impaired people. I'm Jonathan Mosen. It's a pleasure to have you with us here on Monday, the 7th of May. The time is going by really quickly indeed, isn't it? On the program today, age-related maculopathy, also known as macular degeneration. It is, I think, the most common source of blindness, particularly among older folk who become blind later in life, the adventitiously blind. So when there is some breakthrough medically that seeks to treat or perhaps even prevent age-related maculopathy, that's a big story. And Jim Layton of the Radio Information Service in Belleville, Illinois, spoke to a doctor who is working on an exciting new treatment for age-related maculopathy, macular degeneration, and we'll play that interview that Jim has generously provided us with in just a moment. And after that, it's the open forum, courtesy of spiderphone.com. You're welcome to call in and discuss anything that might be on your mind. I'll tell you what's on mine, and you may like to give it a bit of thought during the next 50 minutes or so while Jim has the floor. And that is this whole question of Braille. There was an article recently published, Nation Losing Touch with Braille, talking about the Braille literacy problem in the US, and I think it's a common problem. It was only about 20 years ago that many people were predicting the demise of Braille altogether, thanks to emerging computer technologies. In fact, there has been a proliferation of Braille, thanks to electronic Braille displays and Braille embossers and Braille computer technology, now making Braille so much more easily producible. And yet, Braille does seem to be waning a little bit. Perhaps thanks to the mainstream system, maybe because of computer technology to some extent. And the debate rages about literacy. If you can't read print and write print, and you can't read Braille and write Braille, are you, as a blind person, functionally illiterate? Is it the fact that it's true, it's just such an emotive term that it brings out the worst in people, it makes people defensive? Or is this a term that's used by the Braille elite, normally the congenitally blind who want to kind of impose a set of values on the whole blind community? What do you think about Braille, its future, where it is at present, its usefulness at the beginning of the 21st century? And are you functionally illiterate if you can't read it and you can't read and write print? I'd like to hear your views on that, courtesy of spiderphone.com. We'll give you the contact details right after this interview. Thanks to Jim Layton for making it available to us.
There is a new treatment out there for age-related macular degeneration. Our hard work has paid off. We have a guest in the studio with us today. Joining us from Barnes Retinal Eye Institute is Dr. Shaw. Dr. Shaw, thank you for coming over and welcome to RS.
Well, thank you very much.
Tell us a little about yourself, sir, before we get into MAC and this thing you're doing called PDT.
We practice treating patients with macular degeneration and other retinal diseases, including retinal detachments, diabetic retinopathy, at the Barnes Hospital Complex, and we have multiple offices, both within Missouri and Illinois. Again, one of the biggest problems that we see is the loss of vision from macular degeneration that is being seen by both I and my partners.
Now, you were born in India. When did you come to this country?
I came here when I was 11 years old. We moved to Michigan. Subsequently, then my family moved to Rockford, Illinois, where I went to high school and middle school. I did my medical school training in Chicago, my undergraduate training in Urbana-Champaign. I did my residency training up in Minneapolis. Prior to that, my internship was in California. And my last bit of training of all this was a fellowship at the Wills Eye Hospital in Philadelphia. And I was recruited to come here to Barnes about 2 years ago.
So you've been at Barnes for the last couple of years?
Yes.
Is this something you like doing at Barnes?
Oh, yes. I think that we all enjoy our work tremendously. I don't think that any job that you do is much easier when you enjoy it. You know, we believe that we like taking care of patients. We want our patients to get better. The frustrations we face is with macular degeneration, because not only does it affect the patient, but it also is a tremendous effect on the patient's family. And we're always trying new ways to treat diseases that affect especially the retina, but other eye diseases at Barnes. You know, our motto is to save vision, and I think every one of us, I can speak for my partners, enjoys doing that.
Now, before we get into photodynamic therapy, let's, for the purpose of our discussion, a lot of listeners out there know about macular degeneration, but for those who may be new to it, what is macular degeneration?
Well, first of all, let me just sort of go over briefly in about a minute the anatomy of the eye.
Very good.
And what macular degeneration is. If we think of the eye as a camera, there are different parts of the camera. The you can think of the cover of the camera as the cornea, which is the very front cover of the eye. The lens of the camera being the lens of the eye, that's the part that patients develop cataract and need cataract surgery. The film of the camera is the retina, that's the part that I specialize in. And there's a nerve that goes from the eye to the brain, and I would think of that as the battery of the camera. Macular degeneration is a process of, in very simple terms, it's wear and tear of the macula, which is the very center part of the vision in the eye, in the retina. And it usually affects both eyes with either gradual or abrupt loss of vision. It typically can affect your ability to read, drive, and see fine details. Now, one important thing is, since side vision is typically not affected by macular degeneration, the disease rarely leads to total blindness. It is also not caused by overusing your eyes. That's a common question that people ask me. Gee, if I have macular degeneration, if I use the eyes, am I going to get worse? Absolutely not.
Do we know what causes macular degeneration yet?
There are lots of theories and there are lots of studies on what causes macular degeneration. A basic way to look at it is the retina, again, let's think of it as the film in the camera, or if you're in a room, it's the wallpaper in the wall. What happens is the retina, in order for it to function, it receives nutrition from the blood vessels within the eye. With macular degeneration, the byproducts of the retina functioning, those byproducts are not secreted properly, and instead of being dissolved in the bloodstream, they build up in the retina in very fine deposits called drusen. Your doctor, him or her, may have told you at some point that you have very early macular degeneration. Those are deposits called drusen that are signs that the retina is into the stages of macular degeneration. The problem occurs is when the body sees this deposit and tries to remove them in an improper way, and that's when the new bleeding or blood vessels occur with macular degeneration.
And you talked about the two stages. There's the wet bleeding stage and the dry stage. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Right. There are typically, with a dry type of macular degeneration, the letters that you read may look blurry, since the very cells that are in the center part of the vision can begin to die. They leave blind spots in their area of vision. Sometimes you can typically, patients describe to us wavy lines. When the cells don't work well and degenerate, patients notice a gradual loss of vision. With the wet type of degeneration, you see dark spots in the center of your vision, since there's fluid underneath the macula, the very center. The straight lines appear wavy because there's fluid underneath the macula. And with this type, you can have rapid and severe loss of vision, which occurs when you have these growth of new blood vessels. These blood vessels leak and bleed because they're fragile and they're new. And this is what typically causes the distortion patients complain of.
So the wet is easier to treat than the dry is?
The wet, at this point, there. Let me go back to the dry first.
Okay.
There is a large study that we are participating, that we're in the end of participation, that has looked at the treatment of dry macular degeneration to try to prevent it from getting worse. It's a very light laser treatment. For the wet degeneration, there are more options. but the prognosis is worse for the wet than the dry because the damage is far along. So yes, there are more treatments for the wet, but the prognosis is worse.
Uh-huh. Now, this treatment that you're doing now, photodynamic therapy, tell us about that.
Well, traditionally, there are different types of lasers used in ophthalmology. And the original laser that was used is thermal laser.
Which is a hot laser.
And let me just kind of simplify the differences between that and photodynamic therapy. With thermal, let's think of the retina as a wallpaper in your room. With macular degeneration, there is bleeding between the wall and the wallpaper. What thermal or hot laser does is it destroys the wallpaper along with what's underneath the wallpaper, the new blood vessels. With photodynamic therapy, it's a two-step procedure. The patient first receives an injection of a special dye called Visidyne through a vein in the hand or arm. This dye then circulates throughout the body and only sticks to the abnormal blood vessels underneath the retina. A laser of very low energy compared to a very high energy used with thermal laser is used at this point and does not damage the retina like the regular laser treatment. So in essence, the laser goes through the wallpaper and only selectively affects what's underneath the wallpaper, leaving the wallpaper intact. When the compound is activated within those blood vessels, the blood vessels are closed. Over time, the blood and fluid are then reabsorbed by the body. The problem is, it's important to realize the blood vessels have not been destroyed, but the amount of leakage and growth has been slowed down by the therapy. Unfortunately, this is not a cure. It slows the process down. The goal of photodynamic therapy, or Visidyne is the trade name for the medication, is to prevent further loss of vision. There are some patients who have noticed improvement in vision, but the vast majority of patients, we emphasize and reemphasize the goal is stabilization of vision.
Now, who would be a candidate for photodynamic therapy?
Well,
and how do you determine that?
That's a very good question. Well, with photodynamic therapy, we cannot treat the dry macular degeneration with this.
So you're doing this in a wet state?
Only the wet type of degeneration is just treatable. In addition, the blood vessels must be located in a certain part of the retina for this to be used. And again, let's go back to another simpler example. Also, the blood vessels have to be of a certain type. If you have a garden hose that's leaking from 100 different spots, it's very difficult to pinpoint which part of those 100 spots is causing a problem.
Uh-huh.
If you have a garden hose that's leaking from one big spot, then you can try to fix that with treatment. And that's what photodynamic therapy is useful for. In patients who have leaky blood vessels,
then you can pinpoint
from a spot. You can pinpoint from one big spot. Then in those patients, photodynamic therapy is useful. The way to determine if you have those 100 spots or one spot is a dye test called a fluorescein angiogram.
Been there, done that.
Right. That's a test that it's sort of a roadmap of the eye. It's similar to if you don't know where a house in Belleville is, you get a map of the city of Belleville. And this pinpoints to us where the problem is located in the eye. This dye test, again, you get injected in your arm. The photographer, him or she, takes numerous photographs.
Uh-huh.
We review the photographs and determine whether photodynamic therapy is going to be beneficial for you. And through this test, then, we can determine and follow you.
So if you do this test and we find out that there is maybe one site where there's leakage, we would then do photodynamic therapy?
Right. And then, you know, we talk with patients about their options. Let me just kind of go through a stepwise of how the treatment is practiced.
Yeah, I was interested in that.
What you typically, you know, you have already had the test done to determine whether you're eligible for the treatment. You come into the office. We have a nurse who then measures your body weight and height. The reason that's important because the dose of the drug is calculated from
the Visidyne drug.
That's right, of the drug that's injected into your arm using your body weight and height. Once we have a special room that we do this where you're seated in a machine that looks like a machine that's usually used by our ophthalmologist to examine you called a slit lamp machine. We have a nurse who puts an IV in your arm. that the drug is injected, and it's specifically 15 minutes exactly after the injection we do the treatment.
The laser treatment?
The reason timing is very important because at that point the drug is at its highest concentration within the retinal circulation and within the area of the new blood vessels. If you do it after 20 minutes or 25 minutes, the drug has already passed, and doing the laser treatment is not going to be beneficial.
So you have to be very precise with when you do the laser treatment.
Very precise. We also determine the type of the spot or how big the laser is going to be depending on the measurements we make from your dye test. So once you have the treatment done, we typically place a patch over your eye. The treatment does not hurt. The biggest side effect of the treatment, or that you have to be careful, is you have to stay out of direct sunlight for 3 to 5 days, because this drug is activated by light, meaning you cannot have the drug and go out to a tanning salon. And it's important that you wear long shirts, long pants at the time after your treatment.
Would that burn the skin?
There have been reports in people who have burned their skin. And the way this was found out is in the original study that was done with the drug, patients were divided into two groups, one group that did not get drug and the other one did. Patients who weren't sure if they had the drug or not actually took themselves into the sunlight, and if they got burnt, they knew they had the drug. So that's how they found out that this drug is actually quite toxic when it's exposed to direct sunlight. The other time it's toxic is during those 3 to 5 days if you're involved in an accident and need to have an operation in the operating room. You need to let your surgeon or whoever is doing something on you that you have been exposed to this drug, so the lights they use in the operating room are of a different type than what they typically use.
Now, I understand that it takes somewhere between as minimum of 2 to 5 to as many maximum of 12 treatments in a couple year span. Why so many treatments? Why you just can't get it done in one shot?
Well, what happens is the drug is, again, the thermal laser, the heat laser, destroys the blood vessels. This temporarily closes them in the hopes that at some point the body will try to heal what's left. But if the body does not do that, you have to keep doing the treatments up to a certain point where you sort of win the tug of war. What you're doing is sort of have the body playing catch up where it can catch up and then try to see if it can seal by themselves.
So the first time it may not get the job done then.
Right. The average number of treatments that patients require, and again, everybody's problem is different, is in the very large study that was done, was 2.8 treatments. We typically do one treatment. We wait anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks to 12 weeks to do another treatment. The reason that is because the maximum effect of the treatment is typically noticed at that point, meaning you may actually get a little worse after the treatment temporarily.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yes, that's one of the during the healing phase, you may actually get worse before you get better. Or, again, like the goal we stated was with this treatment is to stabilize vision. One of the problems in treating macular degeneration, I think that's where the new research is sort of focusing on, is trying to stop the process from going to the wet kind initially. And that's where the study that looked at the dry macular degeneration is very important in order to prevent the wet. And there's a multitude of treatments that I think are going to be used in the next 5 to 10 years. I think photodynamic therapy is just one part of the puzzle. I don't think it's the whole puzzle. It's part of the puzzle.
Let's talk about this drug, Visudyne. The Food and Drug Administration has made it for your use. Can you give us some insight on what you go through when the FDA approves a drug, finally to the point that you can use it? Can you give us some insight into that?
Well, Visudyne, it's a very long process that Ciba Vision, which is now Novartis, the company, has gone through. There are numerous stages. First, the drug is tried in animals first. Then the drug is, once it's found to be non-toxic, it's used in human patients who have this condition. The third step if it's compared the results of the treatment effects of the drug in patients who have macular degeneration, and it's done in a fashion where nobody knows whether patients who had the treatment did or did not have the medication. So it's a very long process. Sometimes it can involve anywhere from 5 to 7 years. As with all drugs, we certainly don't know all the side effects of the drug, but the majority of side effects are known. The biggest side effect that we have seen during the treatment, first of all, there's a couple of side effects that are done even while the treatment is being done. One is if the drug gets in your skin, and if the injection is not done properly, it can actually cause a severe burn of the skin, and that has been reported. So that's why we have a nurse who specializes in IV infusion techniques. This is all she does all the time. And that's very important. You cannot have this done by somebody who does this once a month or twice a month or three times a month. Typically, she does these infusions about 10 to 12 in our office, day in and day out. The other side effect that we have noticed is in the study, about 2 to 4% of the patients had severe back pain at the time of the injection. And this back pain is transient, meaning it will go away in literally 1 to 3 minutes. In our population, we found it to be a little bit more common than that, but we've come up with a technique with the use of our colleagues. When patients do get this back pain, if we have them stand up and drink lots of fluids beforehand, the back pain does not seem to occur. So we presume this has to do with the blood pressure in your system at that point. But that's where the biggest side effect that our patients notice is this back pain.
Now, we've talked about side effects on this. Other side effects they've talked about, and I don't know if you've seen them, but they've talked about such things other than the injection site issue and the back pain is the blurred vision, the cataract problem, and visual acuity problems. Have you seen that? And is all this a question of risk versus benefit?
Yeah, you know, we have not seen that. One of the problems is when you have studies or when you have reports that the vision got significantly worse after treatment, you don't know if the treatment made it worse or the disease itself got worse. So those are very difficult issues to sort of sort out.
So in other words, you don't know if the disease made it worse or if the Visudyne made it
worse.
That's
right. That's right. Now, the cataract issue, I have not heard of or I've even seen it reported. But I think that's certainly an issue because anytime you do any kind of treatment in the eye of any kind, you always need to take the risk of the treatment versus the benefits the patient's going to get. And I think most patients do realize that.
Now, we touched earlier on success rate. And some people I've seen on some of these macular degeneration support lists talked about how their vision got a little bit better, but then all of a sudden, it's like a switch, and then the blurred vision came back.
Right. Well, in the statistics, and again, I'm not a big fan of statistics, because if it happens, it's 100%. If it doesn't happen, it's 100%. But I typically tell all my patients that have treatment that about two-thirds of the patients who receive the treatment have stabilization of vision over a year's period. And actually, about 15% will show improvement in vision. The remaining, the vision gets worse. Again, we don't know if the vision gets worse from the treatment or from the disease itself. So I typically tell patients that you have about an 8 or 9 chance in 10 of the vision either staying the same or getting slightly better. So those are the sort of odds that I tell my patients who are going to have treatment. Also, it's very important that if you do have treatment, you need to be able to come back for follow-up, because only then can we determine whether, first of all, whether the treatment is working for you, whether you need to have additional treatments, and also there are concurrent problems that are just not with macular degeneration that can we can help with your vision. Let's go back to the model of the eye being a camera. If the camera is not working properly, you always need to figure out what part of the camera is not working. Is it the lens? Is it the film? Is it the battery? So there are patients who have macular degeneration who are at risk for other eye problems.
So if you're successful with a photodynamic treatment, Do we have any information on how long they'll stay stable? I mean, is there a period of time where they're going to say, oops, need another treatment?
Typically, the studies have shown that, again, since this is a new treatment,
right.
Patients have been stable for up to 2 years out following treatment, meaning they've either maintained the vision or the vision has gotten better for at least 2 years. It may be longer as we get more follow-up on the original patients who were in the study.
So in other words, maybe 2-3 years down the road, you may see that same patient again and do another treatment?
Yes, right. Or they may not need another treatment unless they have gotten worse. If they've gotten worse, then the question is, have they gotten worse because the blood vessels have come back or the bleeding has been causing some other problem? So we typically tell patients that up to 2 years, if that's what we know the data is.
And after they have one of these treatments, when do they see you again? How much follow-up do you do?
We typically see the patient, once they have a treatment, I see them back anywhere from about 6 to 8 weeks following the treatment. At that time, I repeat the dye test. That tells me whether how much leakage is in the eye, how big this spot is, or how small this is. That gives me some prognostic information whether the patient's going to need another treatment or not. So typically I see them back about 6 to 8 weeks later following the first treatment.
That dye treatment's nasty though, Doc.
The dye treatment that...
The times it's been done to me, it wasn't very pleasant.
That's the fluorescein angiogram.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of the biggest problems with the fluorescein angiograms or that patients have is sometimes they can get nausea and vomiting from them.
Oh, yeah.
And patients can have an allergic reaction. If you have had a history of allergic reactions, we typically pre-treat you with medications.
If they're allergic to it, what can they do with
if
that?
If they're allergic to it, we typically give them Benadryl. We pre-treat them. We also give them steroids beforehand, sometimes 2 to 3 days beforehand. Now, there are patients who actually can have severe allergies to this. If that's the case, we actually have an anesthesiologist standing by at the time of the test to make sure that they have any breathing problems, we're in the right hands, and we have every available situation covered. So we actually call fluorescein angiography with anesthesia standby, and that's an important thing to have for patients who have multiple allergies.
Mm-hmm. So you do the dye test before, and then you do the dye test after.
Right. That dye test, again, acts as a roadmap to make sure that you are in the right area, you have measured the spot that you want to treat, and that gives you an indicator of how the patient is doing. Now, okay. In certain patients, let me go back again to the bleeding underneath the retina. If we think of that spot on the wallpaper as if you spill coffee in the rug, all the treatments that are out there are trying to get rid of the coffee. We cannot get rid of the stain the coffee leaves behind. And that's an important point to realize because it's a lot of patients who've had macular degeneration, who've had the wet type of degeneration, they come in with the scar already there. We have no ways of treating the scar. From the problem originally. So that's what I would call the stain from the coffee
okay.
that you spill it on the rug.
Okay, so there's no way to get rid of the scar or the stain or whatever you want.
That's right, because the scar is so intimately involved with the retina that by treating that or removing the scar, we would actually destroy the very tissue we're trying to preserve.
So the Visudyne treatment, just to summarize this, is going to go after that leaking vessel as it's leaking, correct?
That's right. It is not useful for patients who've already had leakage and already had a scar from either a treatment or from the natural course of the disease. But that is the number one misconception that is out there, that this treatment is good for that. The treatment at that point is only going to benefit the doctor who's doing it and not the patient.
So is there anything that we need to talk about the scarring that we can deal with?
There are ways where we actually can do surgery to either remove the scar or we can actually move the scar to a different place, away from the very center part of the vision. These things are very early in the process, but I think progress is being made with what we call macular translocation.
Yes, I've heard that. That's new, though, isn't it?
That's a technique where we actually move the macula, the very center part of the vision, away from the area of the problem. And there is going to be a trial that will be starting at our institute, along with other eye institutes across the country, that patients may be able to partake in this once all the details are finalized. But that's a surgical option. But again, that's an option that carries many more risks than having photodynamic therapy, because again, it's an operation, it's a complicated operation, and it's an involved operation.
So would that help someone who's had MAC for a long period of time, or what, with the scarring?
That would typically help patients who've actually had a macular degeneration for a short time. They have a small area that's affected. If the area that's affected is too large, you can only move the retina
so
or the
far?
Film so much physically. Otherwise, you'd have more problems actually from the surgery than the disease.
Doctor, we've talked a lot about age-related macular degeneration. I'm wondering, we don't see a whole lot of research and treatments and therapies, even like photodynamic therapy, for people with juvenile macular. Why so little research for those people?
One of the reasons is the juvenile degeneration, or we call Stargardt's disease, is a process that actually affects the retina where there's a big dry component of the macular degeneration. One of the difficulties in trying to research this is it's not as common as the macular degeneration that you develop as one gets older. So first of all, it's difficult to find a collection of patients who meet this certain criteria. The other reason, again, it's the research is not being focused in this area, is they're trying to help techniques that relate with macular degeneration that affects as you get older and try to apply those to patients who have degeneration in an early stage. So yes, it is very true that there is not much cure for patients who develop at a younger age. Now, there is recently a gene that has been looked at that looks into where the problem exists, and that's the area where gene therapy is going to be, I think, the paramount way of trying to deal with the problem, because that may be able to predict which patients are going to have this disease if they have a family history or personal history of the disease. And there's a very good person at the University of Iowa, Dr. Edward Stone, that we send our blood samples in patients who have macular degeneration at a young age, who he then looks at their database and tries to determine whether they do carry this ABCR gene.
Now, we were talking about that gene research. That's the LDA4, LDA6, something like?
Yeah, they don't know if it's either 3, 4, 6, or what locus, or what particular area of the gene it's on. But yes, that's in juvenile degeneration, the thrust of the research is trying to determine where the gene is at, because with that, we may be able to have a treatment.
So if we find this gene and locate it, Can we then treat the gene so that the person doesn't get the disease?
I think that is not too far-fetched from the truth, because as the Human Genome Project has, which is a large project that is looking at the blueprint of what we're made out of, and this blueprint may allow us to use gene therapy to trying to prevent this problem. Again, there are many ethical and scientific dilemmas that you can imagine that are associated with gene therapy and its use in patients who have this.
Okay, so it's one way of preventing it. Is the gene working to do anything with people who already have it?
I don't think so.
Good afternoon. You're on TalkBack.
I have macular degeneration, and on my one eye, I had laser surgery. I guess that's about 7 or 8 years ago. And now I have it in the other eye, and I went out to see the retina specialist, and I decided not to have the laser surgery. Again, I thought I'd try it and see how it worked, but it hasn't improved any. It's getting worse. Is there anything? Am I a candidate for something like this?
Did you have the hot laser, the thermal laser treatment, do you know?
Let's see, it was about 7 or 8 years ago.
It'd probably be the hot, wouldn't it?
Yes, yeah, you probably had the thermal laser in one of your eyes. That's the kind where you probably, the vision out of that eye, you can see in the peripheral part of the eye.
Right, you're right.
But you can't see in the very center part. It's
right,
like a spot
right.
In the center.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this other eye, it again depends on what type of degeneration you have and what the degeneration looks like.
Well, He said it was similar to the one I had in the other eye, but I thought, well, why go through laser surgery again when I didn't get any better, you know?
Right, and as we talked about at the beginning of the show, there are different kinds of lasers. The laser that is used now is much different than what you had. But again, with the goal with all laser treatments, and let me reemphasize that again, is to try to keep the vision at its current level. Certain percentage of patients may get better after the treatment, but the goal is to keep the vision where it's at.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always your choice whether you want to have or not have a treatment.
Mm-hmm.
But in the year 2001, if you had macular degeneration with new blood vessels in the very center part of the vision, which it sounds like what you have,
yeah, that's
then,
right.
Then the thermal or hot laser is not the standard of care, meaning you may be best served by the photodynamic therapy or this laser that tries to leave the retina without damage from the laser itself.
Do you think it's too late now to try anything?
No, I think, it depends on what you have. I would mention to him or her the therapy called photodynamic therapy.
The rod with the pellet that time releases that medication into the blood vessels. Can you talk about that for a minute or two?
Sure. It's a treatment called a steroid implant. And steroids have many different uses in medicine. One of the uses of steroids is it can prevent the growth or cause regression of new blood vessels. This has been used in patients who have ocular histoplasmosis, which is a fungus that is endemic to the Mississippi Valley. This causes the growth of new blood vessels underneath the retina.
Are these abnormal blood vessels?
What's that?
These blood vessels are abnormal blood vessels?
These are abnormal blood vessels. The same sort of process that occurs in macular degeneration,
okay,
except it affects younger patients. This implant currently has been used by my partner, Dr. Matt Thomas, in his patients who have ocular histoplasmosis, since he's one of the world's authority on this subject. The problem with the implant that has occurred is steroids can have side effects in the eye. One is cataract formation, and two is the pressure in the eye can go up. Currently, when the implants were first being used, the dosage of the steroid, it was unclear what was the best dosage. Now we have a better idea after those initial set of patients that we have treated and other people have treated of what may be an ideal dose. So now there's going to be a trial that's going to look at whether the steroid implant is useful in patients who have uveitis or inflammation in the eye. The
uh-huh.
next logical approach for the company is going to be used for patients who have macular degeneration. The implant is an implant that actually is, it looks like a capsule. The capsule is actually put into the eye itself. It is sutured into the back part of the eye. This area bathes the retina with fluid, and the steroid is within this fluid. Typically, a steroid implant lasts anywhere from 1 to 2 years. And this implant is done, it's with a surgical procedure in the operating room that typically takes about 45 minutes or so.
Now, you were telling me that at one point the couples of implants were removed because the dosage was too high?
Well, the implants were removed because patients had the pressure in the eye was going too high and they developed what we call steroid-induced glaucoma.
Ouch.
So that's... it's another problem that the patients had that we had to circumvent, which is bringing up the issue. Anytime you have a new medication or a new treatment, there are going to be side effects that are unexpected that are going to happen. And but now I think that the dosage, we have a better idea because now we know that a certain subset of patients who had this dose had effects of the treatment but did not develop the side effects of the pressure. There are certain patients who not only had the effects of the drug, but also developed those side effects. And this may be dose-related.
So if you lower the dosage and they get a success rate, do you stay there or do you raise it up a little more? Do we keep playing with dosages there?
I think you typically, if you've got a dosage that works, you typically don't play with something that works.
If it broke, don't fix it.
That's right.
Another area, and it's kind of related, is this drug I've been hearing about, PKC-412. It's supposedly another blocker, I guess we could call it, a chemical which is to block the abnormal growth of blood vessels, the retinal blood vessels that we've been talking about, Do you see that as another part of the arsenal here to fight the disease?
Yeah, I think there are many anti-angiogenesis. And angiogenesis just basically means growth of new blood vessels. There are many drugs that are used both in the eye and in other parts of medicine that are useful to prevent the growth of new blood vessels. This is another one in its early stages of development for the use in macular degeneration. Actually, it was, I believe, originally used in cancer patients.
Okay. Good afternoon. You're on TalkBack.
Good afternoon, Doctor. I see different figures in, like, silver patterns.
You know, what you're seeing, there's a phenomenon in patients, there's actually a syndrome called the Charles Bonnet syndrome. That syndrome occurs in patients who have macular degeneration.
All right, we both have that, and she has the same thing.
What typically happens in those is patients, actually, first of all, they come in and say, well, gee, I think my husband or spouse or somebody thinks I'm crazy because I'm seeing vivid images of tigers, lions, colors. What that is the brain is stimulated in a different way in certain patients who have macular degeneration. And that's where the problem occurs, that you're not imagining these things. These are normal things that happen in patients with macular degeneration.
Because the brain functions differently?
Well, what happens is the input from the eye to the brain is altered by the macular degeneration. They will see different mosaic or different patterns. Patients describe it as the best 4th of July fireworks they've ever seen in their life. It's many different patterns, but these are vivid, true images that people have. And a lot of people feel like they're developing schizophrenia when they have this, but actually it's from their macular degeneration.
Is there a treatment for this?
There is no treatment for this. This is a transient phenomenon. It occurs and it goes away by itself.
Huh.
But this is a known phenomenon that has been written about extensively in literature, and it's called the Charles Bonnet syndrome, because Dr. Charles Bonnet, who actually himself was an ophthalmologist who had macular degeneration, experienced this phenomenon.
Optobionics.
Okay.
And the computer chip implant.
Mm-hmm.
There has been a lot of press coverage on that, of course. What's your thoughts on that? Is that where we're going to go in the future? Have we seen any more on those three people? Do we know any more about them?
I think that was a one of the problems with that is, Stevie Wonder.
A lot of press from that.
I got a lot of press from that. And unfortunately, whenever you have a procedure that is has more information in the press than the scientific community, that there's a problem. Mark Hamayan, who's a colleague of ours at Johns Hopkins, who's known to us, has sort of been the pioneer in this field. And I think it certainly is a great thing that he's doing in trying to treat patients who have problems that require this. The patients they're treating are patients who have retinitis
pigmentosa, right?
Which is a disease that can affect at any age, but typically takes away your night vision. And what they've been able to do is in patients who have been totally blind, have not been able to see light for many years, in a certain subset, I believe they have done about 10 or 12 of these surgeries, and about 3 or 4 have been able to see the light. They've not been able to read, they've not been able to do anything else, but they've been able to tell whether the light is on and off. So I think this technology is certainly evolving. And I think it's going to be years before this becomes an acceptable way of treatment, but it certainly is a novel approach to treating the problem. Now, a common question that's asked to us is, well, if we can transplant organs, why can't we transplant the eye? Or why can't we transplant the retina? We can transplant let's go back to the camera. We can do corneal transplants without any problems. The success rate of the corneal transplants is very good. The difficulty of transplanting the retina is there are 1.2 million fibers that go from the retina to the brain through the nerve, and we don't have a roadmap for this. So it would be like if we disconnected everybody's half of St. Louis's electricity and try to reconnect it without a map. That's the difficulty of transplanting the retina. There are certain cells being transplanted that can be useful. But again, that is still early in development, but that's another issue of called RPE, or retinal pigment epithelial cell transplantation.
And the big issue was when they were doing the tissue cell transplants back in 95, 96, 97 at Barnes, was the cell rejection.
Right. That's with any transplant issue, rejection is always going to be a problem.
And they basically pulled up their tents and left.
Right. Well, there were other issues that sort of...
Because of the cell rejection, I mean, they were looking for a drug to fight that, and they never really did find it, did they?
Right. Well, one of the problems was that anytime when you have this third development, there are many companies who are interested in this. Once you have not had too many good results, your capital in order to do this becomes difficult for you to do further research. A newer transplantation issue that has come up is using placental cells, which again leads to a whole new issue of ethical issues. And moral
right.
issues. So the area of transplantation is certainly ripe for new techniques, and there are lots of people who are doing different types of transplantation in the laboratory, but there may be a scattered one or two reports. There was a person at the University of Chicago, a patient with macular degeneration, who actually had retinal cell transplantation.
She didn't do that well, though, did she?
No, she did not. So the problem with this disease is this is a disease that at this point we have some treatment, but we don't have a great treatment. This is a disease where people are desperate, they have loss of vision, and they're trying to do everything they can. Which brings me to another subject matter before we run out of time that I just
right.
want to touch on, is the use of vitamins in macular degeneration.
Right.
Every patient I see, they ask me, well, what can I do to try to prevent this? Can I take lutein and zinc and any other vitamins that are out there? My reply to them is I recommend one multivitamin tablet a day.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't know if taking mega doses of vitamin helps. All we can tell you is taking the vitamin one tablet a day does not hurt.
This is for prevention.
For prevention of macular degeneration.
Now
there is going to be a large trial in about 5 years that will have the results whether using a multivitamin tablet can prevent the early stages of macular degeneration.
Okay, before we run out of time, we want to talk about that for just a minute or two longer. Drugs for prevention is totally different than these home cures after.
That's right.
Obtaining MAC.
There are many cures out there.
Let me give you a list, and you can kind of like just go along with the list here.
Sure.
We've seen you talked about vitamins, mega doses of vitamins, microstimulation, acupuncture. There's a whole bunch of stuff on acupuncture. Drinking large amounts of green tea, leafy vegetables, spinach, the whole list. Is there any benefit whatsoever for a person who already has the disease using these kind of home remedies?
Absolutely not. You can certainly try these things, but there has been no scientific evidence that having acupuncture, having stimulation of your eyelids, wearing magnets in your shoes, drinking gallons of green tea is going to make your vision better.
What is it with the green tea?
I don't know. I think the Green Tea Council must have had this notion that it helps with macular degeneration. But green tea has been shown, or people think has shown beneficial of macular degeneration, cancer, host of other problems. But you may take these medications and think that you're better, and about 30% of the effect in any kind of medication is what we call a placebo effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important effect, since if you think you're better, you will believe that you're seeing better, even though you're not better. If that makes sense to you.
So any good response they get is anecdotal then?
That's right. That's right. The only way to determine whether treatment is going to help is when you do a study that compares patients who have the same disease who do and do not have the treatments. And that's where all the large trials have shown.
And when do we get the zinc research?
In about 5 years, the patients have already been recruited. They've already had the initial follow-up. And they want to have a 5-year follow-up on these patients. These are nurses from the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston.
And we'll see that in about 5 years.
5 years.
Dr. Shaw, we're just about out of time. I'd like to ask you, sir, if someone wants to get in touch with you, maybe talk to you about doing photodynamic therapy, give us the number again.
The number is 314-367-1181. We also have a website if patients want information about retinal diseases and photodynamic therapy, www.BRI, stands for Barnes Retina Institute, WUSTL.edu. And that's a very important site that you can get information for you and your family members regarding retinal diseases, not only macular degeneration, but other problems.
All right. Dr. Shaw, we thank you so much for coming over and giving us insight to these diseases and treatments. It's been a real pleasure to have you today, sir.
Well, I appreciate your time and your listeners' time.
And we very much thank Jim Layton of the Radio Information Service in Belleville, Illinois, in the United States, for making that interview available to us on Blindline. And I have to say, if it wasn't for Jim, we wouldn't have a blind line at all today, because unfortunately that's where we're going to have to leave you. I can't get Spiderphone to talk to me today. I think it's SSL server maybe on the blink. Hope that's not too serious for them, but it does mean that we don't have a mechanism for you to call in. And of course, with the recent demise of Lipstream, it's getting harder and harder to find ways to talk to you, isn't it? It's really amazing how all of these internet companies are falling over. Maybe we have been part of this golden age of free advertising-supported services, but there you go. We're still here. But not here to take calls, unfortunately, because we don't have a mechanism to do that. And I'm sorry for that, because I know that many of you will have been giving serious thought to the whole question of Braille that I raised earlier. And hopefully you will keep those thoughts, because we'll reschedule it again for discussion next week, and all being well, we will have telecommunications facilities to allow you to participate in Blindline. I will tell you, though, that, of course, this Blindline will repeat all sort of 50 minutes or so of it. And also, there's lots of good stuff happening over on the other streams. The ACB Radio Treasure Trove has a whole new lineup of shows for May. Make sure you check that out, including some good science fiction this month. Journey into Space is there, Operation Luna. And also Childhood's End, the dramatization of that fascinating Arthur C. Clarke book, some X-1s. But it's not all science fiction. In honor of audio description this month, we have lots of Lux Radio Theatres for you from the days where they did radio adaptations of movies. Over on the ACB Radio Cafe, more groovy music by blind musicians. And of course on ACB Radio Interactive, well, you just never know what's happening there, but I'll tell you. And you can check the schedule. You'll be in time for the last 10 minutes of Kelly Sapirge's highly excellent KJS show if you tune in now. And then it's Living on the Edge with Will and Denise. Yes, nice way to get ragey for the end of the weekend, if it's still Sunday where you are. So thank you, and sorry we can't have a chat. I was looking forward to talking Braille. We hopefully will be able to do that again next week. And I'm crossing my fingers and knocking on wood and all of those things that facilities will be back in action, so that we'll have 2 hours of Miller Time and Blind Spot. More live talk radio starting at 1 Universal on Tuesday. That's Monday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 Pacific. I'll leave you with this.
Someone sharing a delight, chat, this and that, and cocktails for two, as we enjoy a cigarette, to some exquisite chansonette. Two hands are sure to slyly meet beneath a serviette, with cocktails for two. My head may go reeling, but my heart will be obedient, with intoxicating kisses for the principal ingredients. Most any afternoon at 5, we'll be so glad we're both alive. Then maybe fortune will complete the plan that all began with cocktails for two.
That all began with cocktails.